Welcome to the Edible Community Show. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains, a member of the Edible Communities Publications. And each week during this hour, we bring you stories that celebrate the culinary heritage of our dynamic food communities throughout North America. And today's show is about celebration on a variety of levels. My first guest, Julie Schaefer, is the Sustainable Food Service and Education Coordinator at Emory University. She was the founder of the Slow Food Chapter in Atlanta, and she's currently on the Board of Governors for her region. Julie's created some impressive partnerships to celebrate this holiday season, and she's going to be here to tell us a lot about them. And in the second half of my show, I'll be introducing you to Zora O'Neill and Tamara Reynolds. They're two dynamic women who have a new cookbook that puts the party back in dinner party. I want to thank our host today, Fairway Market. Anyone who shopped there knows that they're like no other market. And we'll just take a quick break. We'll get Julie with us, and we'll be right back. To the Heritage Radio Network and the Edible Community Show. And let's thank our sponsor again, Fairway Market, who's like no other market. So the holiday season is upon us, and turkey is on everyone's mind. My first guest, Julie Schaefer, is the Sustainable Food Service and Education Coordinator at Emory University, and she's created a unique event that's going to be taking place on their campus. But that's just a part of what Julie has going on at Emory, and she's here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Deborah.
I'm so excited that you could join us today because I know this is a really busy time for you and everyone on the campus. I wondered if you could, if we could start by having you tell us a little bit about the present moment, what actually brought us together. You had sent out some information about this wonderful initiative you've created, and I was very excited about it. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about it and how it all came about.
Well, you probably received the press release that we sent out about our Heritage Harvest Feast here at Emory.
I did.
Possibly through Patrick at Heritage. And well, this is the second year in a row that we've worked with Heritage Foods USA to create a Heritage Harvest Feast at Emory. And I guess it happened because of my connection with Patrick, quite honestly. Patrick was the president of Slow Food USA when I became the leader of Slow Food Atlanta. And as a matter of fact, he's the guy that sort of convinced me that I needed to start a chapter here in Atlanta in 2000. And we've been pretty good friends ever since.
Well, I guess what you've done is more than just bring in some turkey, though. I mean, you've created an opportunity to really educate people about what the heritage breeds are all about and the importance of preserving them. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you do that. How many meals will you be serving?
We'll be serving 45,000 meals on Thursday, if you include the hospitals. And we do have a couple of hospitals here connected with the university. And, yeah, I mean, what better moment is there to teach about heritage and sustainable food than over a delicious Thanksgiving meal? And at Emory, we're having our Thanksgiving meal a week before the actual holiday because the students will be going home for the holidays. So we're having our Thanksgiving meal here on campus this coming Thursday, the 19th. And I just, you know, had thought from the beginning that it was the perfect opportunity to teach about food culture and traditions.
And how do you do that?
Diversity, protecting it, sustainability, and I'm the Sustainable Food Service Education Coordinator here, so that's part of my job description.
It fits right in. How do you do that? Do you have something at the table? Is this during the lunch or the dinner hour?
It's during the lunch hour.
And so
to be at all the dining venues across the campus. There are many scattered around. And we're going to have the heritage breed turkeys on carving boards, you know, at stations. And we are going to be serving the broad-breasted whites next to the heritage turkeys so that the students can taste for themselves the difference between the heritage breeds and the industrial turkeys.
And for someone who hasn't been fortunate enough to taste the two birds, what do you think are some of the things someone might notice that are different?
I think flavor. I think the heritage turkeys have much more flavor than the industrial turkeys. And the texture is quite honestly different, too, because the turkeys, the heritage turkeys, are athletes. You know, they run and they peck and they move around. And a feedlot bird is confined and, you know, doesn't get any exercise, maybe doesn't even see the light of day. So our birds, our heritage birds, are more muscular and may require a knife.
As opposed to... Now, how will they be prepared? Do you prepare them differently? Or, I mean, do you stack the deck in any way by what you offer with each bird?
I'm not a chef, but I'm sure they'll be brined and roasted and seasoned well. And we're actually using Chef Virginia Willis's recipes for the Thanksgiving feast. She's a famous local chef that we admire a lot, and she's been a guest chef for us a number of times, including last year for our Thanksgiving meal. So this is Heritage Harvest Feast Take 2, starring Heritage Breed Turkeys and Chef Virginia Willis.
Which sounds very exciting. And then how do you, I mean, that gets everyone's attention that one time of year, and that certainly got mine. But I think what's really noteworthy as well is what you're doing all year long. So perhaps you could share with us a little bit of how you've brought this notion of sustainability onto the campus through your efforts, what farmers you're working with. 45,000 meals is a lot of people to feed on an ongoing basis.
It is.
Is there that much food out there, sustainable food in your area?
Good question. And yes and no. There's not from Georgia, but there is from our 8-state region. And so we have defined local, and the highest priority goes to Georgia farmers. And we've worked very hard to cultivate relationships with farmers here in our state to source local and sustainable food products. And then a second priority is our 8-state region, which includes Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, and Mississippi. So the broader region recognizes the limits of the Georgia growing season. And, you know, when we can't get things here in Georgia, we often can in Florida.
Which is terrific, and
yeah.
Not a bad recommendation, perhaps, for people all over the country who might need to broaden their region. And then I guess you and I spoke a little bit earlier today about your evolving view of sustainability, and I'm wondering if, in a way, some of this doesn't tie in. You know, locavore meaning within, for some people, 50 miles, for some, 100. Now, with what you're tasked to do, that would certainly be far too limiting. How is this informed that?
You know, in all honesty, I did not create Emory's Sustainable Food Initiative or vision, and I have been brought on board about a year and a half ago to help implement it, and it's very exciting. It's a real interesting challenge, particularly since I've been involved with Slow Food for so long and have watched with great excitement as momentum is built for the local sustainable food movement. And, well, you know, if I tell the truth, we couldn't feed everybody in Atlanta just from Georgia, because while we're a huge agricultural state, we ship 90% of our ag products outside the state. And that's just kind of the way the industrial food system has evolved. And now we're looking at ways to try to change it and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's not working very well, and so we're looking for solutions, and we're kind of breaking new ground as far as I can tell.
In what ways? What are some of the things you see happening that make you hopeful?
Well, I'm involved in the Real Food Challenge, which is a network of colleges and universities all over the country who are committed to sourcing food sustainably, locally whenever possible, but organically from other parts of the world when they can't get them local. And I think that's a real great start. And our food contractor is Sodexo, a large international food service provider, and they're on board with this. I mean, they're very supportive in our sustainability initiative and are really helping to make it happen, not only here at Emory, but at other colleges and universities throughout the United States, and several right here in the metro Atlanta area, Georgia Tech and Kennesaw College. So, they're good at seeing the big picture, and they know that to keep the business of universities like Emory, who has a commitment to sustainability across the board, not just with respect to food, but everything from energy to water conservation, recycling, and so on and so on, that they're going to have to step up to the plate and, get help to facilitate these kinds of connections. And now, they're doing a good job. And we've worked through a couple of distributors, one here called Destiny Organics, the only certified organic distributor of produce in the Southeast. And together with them, we worked very hard to cultivate relationships with farmers and producers all over the South.
And can you share with us a story or two of someone you've worked with over the past few years that you've seen their business change and the entire model change? Just to give folks an idea of how this may work, because I think it seems kind of daunting if you think about how do you get a university environment to get rid of French fries, for example, or something. Could you give us an example of sort of where to put your toe in or some ways to start?
Well, yeah, and I think that it's not a black or white thing, and I think a lot of people think that, oh, I've got to do it all one way or another way. Even home consumers, forget that there are all kinds of shades of gray in between, and every little thing that you do makes a difference. For instance, if a college or a university or another institution, say, a hospital wanted to start, a good place to start would be with recycling and composting. Another good start would be local dairy. Local dairy, most states have dairies, and that's often a very easy place to start. And here in Georgia, we have a cattle ranch that supplies us with wonderful grass-fed beef, and every Wednesday we have White Oak Pastures grass-fed beef. We can't serve it every day because the demand actually exceeds the supply at this point, but we have it on Wednesdays, and we call it White Oak Pastures Wednesdays. And then on Friday we have Springer Mountain Farms chicken. So we spotlight those farms on certain days. And it would be nice to be able to use those products all of the time, every day of the week, but right now we're not able to. So, we're taking baby steps, and baby steps count, and they're good. And
absolutely.
I think you have to start somewhere, and starting small is fine. We're actually at a pretty good place. We have an ambitious goal of sourcing 75% of the foods that we serve on campus locally and or sustainably by 2015. And that's a pretty ambitious goal.
Very.
We just really started this a couple of years ago. And right now we're at, depending on the time of the year, between 38 and 48%.
Fantastic.
And depending when students are here, depending on availability of products, et cetera. So it's pretty exciting to watch that happen. And it's been really exciting for us to build relationships with local farmers. And, you know, they do have to go through a distributor because we're an institution and we have all kinds of rules and regulations and insurance liability restrictions, et cetera. But we've all worked together to make it happen, and it's very inspiring. I'm really excited about it. And I think it's wonderful that we're serving the heritage breed jerkies because it teaches students another whole part of sustainability, and that is preserving endangered breeds. And, you know, to many students and to many people, not just students, but even educated professionals, a cow is a cow is a cow, a turkey is a turkey is a turkey. And people don't realize that there are breeds, and in fact, breeds that are in danger of extinction. And the really exciting part of this turkey project, to me, is that these rare breeds in 2002 were on the verge of extinction. And with the Heritage Breed Turkey Project initiated by Slow Food in 2002, when Patrick Martins was the president of the organization, those turkeys have now been taken off the endangered list and placed on a watch list. So that's big progress.
Right.
I'm very excited about that. And it's important. I know it sounds paradoxical, but you have to eat them to save them.
And, right. which is, I think, a little hard for people. But you have some good news in terms of this whole eating them to save them. You've got some exciting news about another breed, I think, that you're working with in Georgia.
We do have some exciting news, and it's not been made public yet, so I'm not going to go into detail, but I just returned from the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy Annual Conference in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we are at Emory going to be saving a breed of cattle that are, well, not exactly indigenous to this area, but have been living in this area for about 500 years. The Spanish conquistadors brought lots of breeds of animals to our area, you know, to Savannah, and they moved up to our area. And so they've been here for 500 years, and some of these breeds are dying off. In fact, there are only several hundred head of this particular breed left in the United States. And Emory Dining in particular, has decided to take on another conservation project and really try to create a viable market for this particular breed, and they're so rare at this point that it's going to take 2 years of planning, and it will be a one-day event to start with. So you know, you have to start slowly and be happy with baby steps, and we hope that 10, 15 years from now, there'll be a viable market for this particular cattle breed. And I'm not going to say too much about it because we want to launch the project with a big bang a little bit later on in the year.
Well, we'll have to have you back when you are ready to talk about that. Now, do you tie the curriculum in at all? Are there student programs at Emory where students can become engaged in this on an actual academic level?
There are. We have a master's degree in sustainable development. It's interdisciplinary, and we're in the process of creating a minor in sustainability. And there are many courses across the curriculum that do incorporate ideas about sustainability and sustainable foods into their curriculum. In fact, there's a course in anthropology, Dr. Barlett's Fast Food, Slow Food course. And, you know, a lot of students take that and get really jazzed about the whole sustainable food movement, really inspired. And Dr. Barlett is the one who got the ball rolling for the whole sustainable food initiative here at the Emory campus. So she's really been great, to a real innovator and a real visionary.
Well, and obviously they're going to say some of those same things about you with some of the things you're doing, I'm sure. And one question I have for you, Julie, is how did you get involved in all this? I mean, what brought you to your – I mean, I know you said you had known Patrick, and he encouraged you to start the Slow Food chapter. But what is some of your background that led you to caring about this so passionately?
Well, I grew up in rural Ohio, and my grandparents were Mennonite farmers. And so I grew up around people who were raising their own food, had their own animals, grew their own fruits and vegetables, preserved them, and ate only the food that they raised and created and, you know, harvested that food and lived on it all year long. And they lived to be in their hundreds, too, I might add. I think they lived very well and ate very well. And some of my fondest childhood memories are of the times that I spent with my grandmother weeding in the garden, but harvesting was the most fun. And then, you know, we would also forage in the woods for wild edibles. And my grandmother taught me what was edible. And we'd go mushroom hunting and hunting for, you know, wild salad greens. And, oh, that was so much fun. And so I've just always, I think because of my agricultural family roots, I've always had an interest in food. And, well, I've always loved eating good food, but farming has been of interest to me, and I taught high school art for 30 years. So when I retired from that, I really came back to, you know, I felt really drawn back to food and farming, and I've always been a farmer advocate. And when I found out about the Slow Food Organization, I was on a trip in Italy in 1999, and I thought, wow. I thought it was a local club, but then I Googled it and found out it was a big international organization, and I started reading about Slow Food, and I got really excited, and I thought, wow, this is an organization I could really get behind. You know, I feel like I've been kind of swimming upstream in a fast food world and trying to be more traditional, and not that I was anti-fast food, I was just for a different type of food and different way of doing food. And so when I found out about this organization, I got really excited, and that's when I called Patrick about joining a chapter in Atlanta, and he said, there isn't one. Would you consider creating one? Isn't Atlanta a really big city? Don't you need a Slow Food chapter? And while I really just wanted to be a member, since there wasn't a chapter, I went ahead and formed one, and we started with 33 dues-paying, card-carrying members who were already members of the organization. So in the beginning, it was a simple matter of organizing them and saying, hey, I'm starting a chapter. Do you want to be involved? And most of those people are still involved. And at last count, I believe we have close to 700 members.
Oh, wow.
Members. So that's pretty good growth. And I think the timing is right. I think there's, you know, for a while, I would say that local and organic food was a trend, but I think it's grown beyond a trend to a cultural paradigm shift. And is it mainstream? Well, maybe not exactly, but the fact that Walmart is carrying organics, it says a little bit about the fact that it is going mainstream and that it truly is a cultural paradigm shift. And I think... am I talking too much?
Not at all. Okay. I'm very interested, and I think everyone listening will be too.
Okay, well, if I'm just going on too much and you want to ask me specific questions, just stop me. But I think that most people generally agree that there are problems with our food system and that need to be fixing. And the fact that we have an organic garden growing on the south lawn of the White House is very symbolic of the willingness of our administration to take a look at what's broken about our food system and fix it. And I've been very privileged to be a part of a conversation that Slow Food has been having with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which, as you probably know, are located here in Atlanta. And we've been in conversation with their Department of Nutrition, physical activity, and obesity for about 2 years now. And We've gotten Alice Waters and Michael Pollan, Josh Viertel, the president of Slow Food USA, Erica Lesser, the executive director of Slow Food USA, and this spring we're bringing Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food International, to Atlanta to speak with the CDC. And so I feel really, really good about that conversation, that the people who can affect policy are asking us questions and taking notes when we talk. It's very exciting.
It's a big shift.
We're entering into these kinds of conversations with people who have the power to affect change.
It's very exciting, and I think Carlo Petrini would probably be surprised if he, I don't think he ever would have thought, right, when he first began all this, that it would come full circle in this way.
It's been interesting to watch how Slow Food, the organization, has evolved from one of education to more of an activist organization, and that's really where we're headed. Particularly here in the U.S. with our Time for Lunch campaign. It's a very focused campaign to get the attention of our Congress people and our lawmakers. The Child Nutrition Act is up for reauthorization this year by Congress, and so we've had a very focused effort to get their attention about creating change, you know, right in schools where kids learn to eat. I mean, they learn about healthy food as their children, and that's the place we need to start. And here in Atlanta, we also have a Slow Food on Campus chapter at Le Cordon Bleu Culinary College. And that's a 15-month program, and a lot of students come through that program. And Le Cordon Bleu has actually incorporated Slow Food principles and philosophy into their curriculum nationally. And that's pretty exciting.
Very.
And we have a Slow Food on Campus chapter here at Emory, too, and they're very involved and very active. And so it's really exciting to see colleges embracing the idea of slow food, and I just feel really excited to be a part of what's going on here at Emory.
Well, I thank you so much for spending time with us today. I mean, you're really doing it in a big way, and I'm delighted that you sent out that information so I could learn all about your initiative with the turkeys and then learn about everything else that's happening there.
Well, stay tuned for our announcement about our cattle breeder, too.
I will. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Have a great holiday, Julie. Take care.
Hope you will too, Deborah. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to the Edible Community Show, and I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro. And I'm here with two very exciting women, Zora O'Neill and Tamara Reynolds. And they have written a great new book called Forking Fantastic. And it's putting the party back in dinner party, which all of us need to be thinking about around now with the holiday season coming up. And I think they're going to be a little low energy because from what I understand, they had one of their fabulous Sunday night dinners last night.
Oh, thank you for giving us that preface to our interview today.
No, problem. And I hope I...
Hot tea. We're good. We're good to go.
You're having some hot tea. Is that what you said? Okay. Well, and it's Tamara, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Did I say it the right way? Okay, great. Yes. I wasn't sure. I didn't want to mispronounce your name. But
no, thank you. You're right on.
I spoke with Zora a little earlier today, and I said I expected to like the book, but I really love the book. I have quite a few cookbooks. I'm older. I'm a little older than the demographic I see pictured around some of these tables in the book.
Oh,
but I love... Pardon me? I missed that. What did I miss something funny?
Oh, I said you'd be surprised at how old the demographic is at the dinner table.
Oh, I guess it ranges.
It's yes, very flattering lighting also.
That always helps. But you have a lot of great tips and wonderful ideas. I thought it'd be fun to start, though, with what was on last night's menu to give our listeners a little sense of how you kind of approach putting one of these parties together, and that'll give them some insight into the book. And then we'll tell them a little bit about the two of you and how you even got involved in this crazy mess. So tell us about last night. How did that all come together?
Well, we just got back from a book tour, which took us to some places we had been and some places we had never been. And, of course, you know, you have to eat 3 squares a day while you're out promoting your book, at least.
At least.
And, unfortunately, when you're out promoting a book, there's really no chance to eat in anyone's home. I mean, it's all, like, restaurant food and, you know, whatever you can grab. So we had eaten some things when we were on the road, and then we've been cooking together now for a little over 6 years, almost, I guess we're coming up on our 7th anniversary. And, what are we going to do for that? Are we going to the Bahamas?
I'm looking at packages right now.
Awesome. Good. So last night was sort of a culmination of things. I made a list about a week and a half ago of things I was thinking about, and they all turned out to be things that we had eaten other places, things that basically we ripped off from other people, like all of the best recipes, right? I mean, are there ever any real new ideas? I don't think there are. So, and when the first really big event dinner that we cooked together 6 years ago it started out as a whole roasted pig, but ended up being a whole pig and a whole lamb at the same time.
Which was great and monumental, but the lamb got all the love. So all these years we've been feeling like we didn't do right by that pig. So last night the centerpiece was a roasted pig on a spit. So we were able to focus all our attention on the pig and give it the attention it deserved. And then Tamara and I put together some other various little side dishes. Like she said, stuff that we borrowed from a restaurant she had in Seattle, these nice little eggs with a pesto and anchovies.
Incredible.
Some bulgur and farro with butternut squash, beet greens. We love beet greens. I don't know.
With
what else?
Roasted beets and aioli. Pickled tomatoes,
which
used to be served at Prune Restaurant, where Zora and I met. We both worked at Prune, and Gabrielle Hamilton used to serve a suckling pig that she'd put in the oven and roast all night, baby, and then pull the pork and serve it with an aioli and these pickled tomatoes that were insane. And we've both been lamenting the fact that we did not manage to pinch that recipe before we got in the restaurant. But thankfully, we found something that looks identical on the internet, the power of the internet, yesterday. So Zora cranked those out on Saturday, and they were amazing, which was really nice.
So a pickled tomato didn't have to be pickled over time?
Oh, I did them overnight. The recipe did call for them being done for 3 days ahead, and I remember that's what we used to do at Prune. But you know, didn't realize that.
Necessity.
Anymore. It was fine.
Yeah.
They were good.
No, I thought they were really good.
Yeah, they were exceptionally sweet little tomatoes.
Yeah, they were the little grape ones, which are the only ones that we advocate buying this time of year. They're the only tomatoes we allow ourselves.
Well, and I'm a little curious about how did loving the pig manifest?
Well, it manifested by being we put it in a garbage bag overnight with a marinade of orange juice and soy sauce and chili and garlic and lots of salt. So we're basically brining it with some other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we wrangled him onto the spit, which took a lot longer than we realized. And fortunately, my husband Peter had taken the incredibly bourgeois step of going and buying a mechanized spit thing. Over the years, we've all always used these ridiculously jury-rigged spit-rigging things, like amazing. And we've always relied on the kindness of our friends to come and start cranking the spit. And usually they do, except we realized we'd done the wrong calculations, and we were kind of doing calculations for lamb and not for pork. And we realized very late in the day that the pork would take a lot longer. So Peter went out and got this totally groovy lamb roasting situation. Because we live in Astoria in Queens, which is like Greek HQ.
Uh-huh.
So we were able to adapt the local tools to our needs.
Yes. We're probably one of the few neighborhoods in New York where you can choose, like there are three different stores that you can price comparison shop on your mechanized lamb turner.
Yes, one of the many merits of living in Queens.
One of the many.
Yes.
I'm sure we should say that there is an edible Queens for people who want to know more about the merits of living in Queens. Since
they're doing a great job. I think they're only their first issue is out, or their second?
Only the first issue is out. Okay. They're putting their second issue to bed right now.
And the first issue has Tamara's recipes in it.
Which is very exciting.
Yeah.
And folks can look for that online as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk a little about how you got together on this. I mean, so 6 years, almost 7 years, when you're going to have your anniversary coming up ago, you said what to each other? What brought you into the kitchen together in the first place?
Tamara and I, when we met at Prune, we were both working there, and I was working as a line cook, and she was working as a server, so we didn't actually interact a whole lot. But then at the Prune Christmas party, I overheard her say, "Oh, and I just trotted back to my neighborhood and picked up a souvlaki." And I was like, "Oh, excuse me, do you live in Astoria?" Because that's about the only place in New York City
mm-hmm.
where it's routine to pick up a souvlaki from a street cart.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, those were the words we spoke. It was incredibly romantic. fondly now.
Love over a souvlaki. That's going to be our joint memoir, I think.
No.
Love over souvlaki. Great title.
Yeah, it was really, it was kind of kismet. I worked at Prune for such a short time, I kind of look back and I'm like, well, I guess the point of me working at Prune was to meet Tamara. You never know. So, and we just sort of, what's nice about our cooking together is we have about the same level of cooking skill in a lot of way, and we have sort of divergent interests also in what we cook. So, you know, Tamara does a lot of French and Italian stuff and a little Middle Eastern. I kind of range further, so we can divvy up the responsibilities pretty evenly, and both of us can contribute different things to the menu. So somehow when we're in the kitchen, it's kind of nice. We just sort of naturally, I don't know, divvy up the tasks.
Yeah, it does.
It
comes very naturally. We're very lucky that way. We also, the first meal we cooked together was a slow-cooked pork shoulder and cranberry beans, if I'm remembering correctly. And I invited Zora over for an afternoon because we did live in the same neighborhood. And we started just cooking together on Sunday afternoons because I had really good cable at the time. I had really good cable, actually. I'm married to a man whose TV is his business, so we have every channel. But we started cooking just for ourselves and a couple of neighborhood friends and, you know, people in our neighborhood, and then it just sort of, it snowballed. It kind of got crazy. Like, people just wanted to bring people, and, of course, we couldn't say no. And it gave us an automatic audience for any sort of crazy idea that we wanted to try, which once we realized how well we got along in the kitchen, then, of course, it was just a breeding ground for insane ideas and big projects like roasting a whole lamb and a whole spit and a whole pig at the same time on a spit on a front deck in New York City, you know.
For your first one, though. That's what's so crazy.
That's the crazy part,
I think.
6 months into it, but...
In terms of, like, one of the first parties where we're like, okay, we'll invite everybody, you know, instead of it being like a low-key Sunday thing. This was like the blowout New Year's party. Anyway, it was a little monumental.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a really nice. It was really nice to begin with because it was this great chance to have sort of immediate cooking gratification that if you're cooking just for yourself doesn't always happen. You're like, oh, that looks good. I'll file that away for later. But if you know you're cooking for other people, which is what we encourage so much in Forking Fantastic, if you know you're going to be cooking for other people, then that's the opportunity to try that recipe. And so we would like read something in the Wednesday food section and turn around and serve it that weekend, which was, you know, great for everybody involved.
Yeah, we definitely do not subscribe to the idea that a lot of chefs tell you to, you know, oh, be sure you practice your dish before you serve it. You know, have a trial go around before you serve it to other people. And our message is exactly the opposite. Don't practice. Just serve it for your friends. You know, get in there and go full bore and hope for the best. It'll all work out. It'll be fine.
Well, now, you had mentioned sort of being a line cook, so that might intimidate some folks. Tamara, I don't know if you have professional culinary training.
I have none.
I have none either. I just talked myself into that job, and anybody, full disclosure, I worked at Prune for like 3 months. Like, obviously, I was not the world's most stellar line cook, so I'd be intimidated.
And I was a waitress.
I tried, but I just... Oh.
Yeah, no. I've never cooked professionally anywhere. I have learned everything, every ounce of kitchen knowledge I have, I've learned the hard way, often two and three times, because the first time wasn't good enough for me, I guess. And Zora also has learned diligently the hard way. I think maybe not as bad as I am. She's a little quicker on the pickup, but.
Well, now, you mentioned, Tamara,
learn from our mistakes, which are little boxes where we say, don't do this, because if you do, this is what's going to happen. And we know that because we actually made all of those mistakes.
Well, and I do love those little boxes. I mean, they really do have some wonderful little tips in there about different things that are really helpful. And they're written in a way that you know you have had the experience.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, other than just observed.
Passing on sort of received culinary knowledge.
No.
You know, this is all tragic experience.
And I would make it sound funny because if you really just read the boxes, it's embarrassing. You should be embarrassed for us.
Well, I don't think it's so embarrassing. I think it makes it much more accessible for people see that.
No, we hope that's really the intention. Like, you can make these mistakes. Like, you know, hopefully you won't make those exact mistakes, but
right.
Even if you make similar mistakes that you have no way of anticipating, even if you make those mistakes, you're fine. Like, dinner is not going to be a total disaster. The key thing is to get your friends in around the table and cook something for them. And even if that goes wrong, there's still pizza. So
right.
Exactly.
The thing is just to establish the party and then go from there.
Well, and I noticed in the book, Tamara, you talk about the book that changed your life, the Edna Lewis book, right?
Yes, yes.
And so I wondered if you could talk a little about culinary influences. And I had the privilege of meeting Judith Jones the other day.
Right.
I was at a conference, and many people know Judith was the person who found Julia Child, right, in a sense. And she's also written a wonderful new book, which is sort of the other extreme. It's Cooking for One.
Yes,
so here's your book about
so
cooking for many, and hers is Cooking for One. It's a beautiful book. But she did, in response to someone, she said, now, you know what Julia would say? She would say, never apologize. You know, so
exactly.
It's sort of the
right.
same philosophy you're talking about. But
yes.
Tell me a little about your influences, both of you, your culinary inspirations.
I have been very inspired, obviously, by Edna Lewis. Just the voice that was in her cookbook was like she was standing there talking to me in the kitchen. And I still, it's a marvel, and it's such an intimate look at a specific way of cooking and of eating. And it's really it's slow food, but we think of slow food, or I think a lot of people think of slow food as in the Slow Food Organization and from Italy and all of that, and sort of an elitist type of a thing. And Edna Lewis's background is, of course, anything but elitist. She was a granddaughter of a sharecropper. You know, I mean, her town was named Freetown for all the freed slaves who occupied it and established it. And I found her window into Southern food so beautiful and so rich and interesting and so much beyond, like, you know, cheese straws and pimento cheese dip, which are in there, too,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot more. And I also I've had a lifelong fascination, I think, with French food. I learned to cook from Gourmet magazine when I first decided to learn to cook when I was married to my first husband and in college and a young Navy wife, and, you know, it was a very different, it was a long time ago, and Gourmet was very French-influenced still at that time, and this was in, I guess we're talking in 1992, when I first picked up Gourmet, and I just loved the building of the sauces and the complexity of it. I found it very beautiful, and that's kind of how I taught myself, and I branched out from there, and the Mediterranean is also, as Zora said, a real inspiration for me, and Zora has been an inspiration for me. I mean, when I met her, I had no idea what a pomegranate molasses, what pomegranate molasses were. I was like, what's that? I hate to think of how much worse my life would be if she hadn't introduced me.
Well, this is so much. And Zora, I want to hear now from you how all that happened. But I do have to comment as I listen to you both. The friendship that you have is so special and distinctive. And it comes out in the book also, but it's really a pleasure to hear your voices together.
Okay.
And sort of have that overlay to it. But I think if people envy anything when they're listening to this program, it's going to be the rapport that you have, to have found sort of a soulmate in the kitchen the way you have, and to have obviously other soulmates in your lives. It's very special. But you really do bring that out in the book and in your language. And you're sort of like cheerleaders for us, going, it's okay, you can do
so.
It.
Yes. And not the annoying kind of cheerleaders.
No. Not at all.
We've been very lucky. It's not, I've cooked with many other people, but it's rare to get such a great partnership in the kitchen. And one that you don't even have to talk a lot in a weird way. You know, like it just works.
So Zora, who are some of your culinary icons that...
Well, it's funny. Tamara was talking about how she learned to cook from Gourmet, and I, on the other hand, learned to cook from Cooks Illustrated, which makes Tamara's head explode, just the mention. And I have to preface, like, I love Cooks Illustrated, and, like, Christopher Kimball drives me insane because it's so dogmatic and so rigid and so, like, this is the right way, which, it's funny, I learned to cook, I taught myself to cook when I was in graduate school, where, like, all you learn is cultural relativism. So it's like, there is no right way. And yet there was something deep in my brain that was like, yes, I will follow what he says, and it will be good. There's so much beautiful information in Cooks Illustrated, even if you disagree with, like, their choice of chocolate, which I do. Even if you disagree with a lot of what they say, there's so much amazing information in there. So, you know, I feel like I have at least a rudimentary understanding of, like, kitchen science just from reading that and, like, looking at the funny illustrations. And I also, the other thing I learned to cook early on was I had lived with a guy in England in a terrible, terrible, memorably awful 6 months where we were totally broke, and we had a Mater Jaffrey Indian cookbook. And my boyfriend was a grad student, so he was home and he cooked. But when we broke up, I got a copy of that cookbook. I can't remember if it was the same one or if I just went out and bought a new one. So I kind of reclaimed all this food we'd been eating all these 6 months, where I was like, this is good, this is good.
Mm-hmm.
And I cooked my way through that cookbook, which was a totally weird way to learn. Like, I never learned French technique or any of that until years later. And but it gave me this whole approach to spices and things that I'm very happy to have. I realize now, like, a lot of people look at their spice rack with extreme trepidation, and it doesn't have to be that way. So.
And so you did what Julie supposedly did in the movie? You went recipe by recipe?
I was nowhere near that methodical. My God. it just sort of happened that way. That was, like, when I started grad school and I went off, well, you know, I had, like, 6 books to my name, and I trundled off, and I just had this cookbook where the pages were kind of stuck together, and I was like, oh, I'll make this, and I kind of alternated, you know, some curry cauliflower with, like, sloppy joes, because, you know, and I'd call my mom and be like, how did we make the sloppy joes? So there was a lot of, you know,
integration.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it all came out fine. And the major thing that happened in grad school, which was so fantastic, and I don't know how people can replicate this experience, I lived with 3 other people, and we were all grad students, so we didn't have much money. We had tons of time on our hands, and 2 each of us cooked two nights a week for the other three people.
Oh, wow.
And so it was just this built-in experiment zone. Uh-huh. And I could go to, like, the Indiana University Library and peruse the cookbook section, which was so much more interesting to me than the section that I should have been studying.
I didn't even know they had cookbooks in libraries until 2 weeks ago.
Really?
No.
And then you
libraries,
found yours
I
there.
Anyway.
I wanted to ask about the chocolate choice. You said you disagree with their choice. What is your choice?
Well, it's funny. I cannot. It's basically whatever. Not what Christopher Kimball says. It's just my contrary. I went to go see him talk at a bookstore here in New York a few years ago, and he did this thing. He was entertaining. He was great. He passed out these little samples of chocolate to everyone in the audience and had everybody taste them, and he was like, who likes this one? Who likes that one? And then basically he was like, oh, you people are right. You, the ones who liked this chocolate, are right. And I was like, what? I got up and left. I was like, do not.
That's hilarious.
Do not. Anyway, don't you realize, like, there are ranges of chocolates? Anyway.
Right, and ranges of taste.
Yeah. Right now I have big blocks of that green and black organic baking chocolate, which is
satisfying
me.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So
now, what do two women like yourselves who have dinner parties every other Sunday night, right?
Well, roughly, and they're not really on Sundays all the time.
Yeah, sometimes they're Wednesday, sometimes Saturday. It just depends on our schedules. Yeah.
So twice a month?
Yeah, about twice.
What do you do for Thanksgiving? Takeout?
No,
I mean, what do you do for a holiday then?
Oh, it's tricky. It's a fine line. We cook so much, and we like what we cook, and we both sort of come from families where, like, food was a thing, and we cared about food, so we both have tastes that were sort of formed in childhood about, like, the way the mashed potatoes are supposed to be. They better
right.
have a ton of butter in them.
Hello.
And, you know, there cannot be any of that green bean casserole because my dad told me it was tacky.
Oh, I like the green beans.
Oh, oh my God. So we are very persnickety. So generally, I have to emphasize, we are fabulous dinner guests, and we are not critical at all. But when it comes to Thanksgiving, there's this terrible moment where we're like, this is not right.
Yeah.
If we go to somebody else's house. So
I'd love to hear from each of you. What would be on the menu for each of you? So Zora, you go first, and then Tamara, you tell us.
Okay. Let's see. Well, you have to have mashed potatoes with the skins on, and there has mm-hmm. to be tons of butter and cream in them.
Okay.
Basically, all my stuff is, like, very basic, not too trendified or anything. Like, ooh, this year, the hot thing is, I don't go with that. Like, the stuffing I like is very basic, like bread and sage and onions, and, you know, I don't go in for, like, sausage and chestnuts and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm perhaps even harder to please than most people.
So you're very traditional about your Thanksgiving table, even though you've had all this experience with Indian spices.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if I'm, like, cooking for a ton of other people, like, one or two of the side dishes might be something I read last week or something, but the core stuff, the turkey, and, you know, and I'm very careful about making the gravy. I don't want anybody else getting in there and, like, adding milk to the gravy or something gross like that.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's
and then do you bake?
Kimball righteousness coming out.
Do you bake? Are you also, I mean, do you bake a pie? Or?
Oh, yes. Great pie opportunities. We just made pumpkin pie last night, actually, to go with the pig. So I was that's kind of satisfied my Thanksgiving urge because I'm actually going to a friend's house. It's in a foreign country, so all bets are off. So I can't.
Oh, fascinating.
She'll do what she can do, and I will not judge, I promise. but, yeah, last night I was able to make some pumpkin pie, which is kind of funny. My dad is visiting now, and we were both, like, squinting at the Libby's pumpkin can and being like, so what do we usually do? And we're sort of together being like, yeah, okay, that's basically the recipe, but then you add a little more this and a little of that and a shot of brandy. So there's sort of this floating. I'm glad my dad was here to talk me through that. So.
Wonderful. And Tamara, what's usually on your Thanksgiving table?
Well, I used to run an orphan's Thanksgiving for years and years when my house doubled as the, as Zora calls it, the Astoria Community Center room. And then I married a wonderful man who happens to have family in town. So now I've been forced to give up the stove for Thanksgiving and be a guest. So I have reinstituted a Saturday night after Thanksgiving dinner with another friend of mine who's her tastes have changed over the years from her family as well. So now we get together on Saturday night and we make our own Thanksgiving of all of the things that either weren't that weren't stat as far as we were concerned or that just didn't appear on the table. So it has it has to be a really good turkey, and it has to be brined over, overnight, preferably for a couple of days. There has to be lemons and rosemary and sage stuffed into the turkey, so the gravy is really sort of lemony. That's something we really love. There must be pumpkin pie. There must be mashed potatoes with a ton of butter and heavy cream in them. There must be stuffing, and we really like the basic, Zora said, the basic sage, onions. But we also add sausage into it, and then I dig it if we can find some oysters and put in, but I don't get all in a snit if we don't do it that way. There must be green bean casserole. And it's hilarious because I only want two bites, but I have to have the two bites. I'm not a cranberry girl, but my husband has to have cranberry sauce two ways. He has to have the kind of the ocean spray out of the can with the ridges on it, and then he also has to have a homemade kind that he made. He was just talking about it last night. He was like, I think I'm going to make it with persimmons this
year. That's a nice idea.
Right on that, baby.
Yeah. I'll have to have some of that. I'm a cranberry fan.
Yeah. And then there also has to be some sort of really fairly harsh green vegetable, like it could be just dandelion greens or Swiss chard or something that's sort of unadorned and just as is for the whole, it's good for your digestion.
Kind of an antidote to all the richness.
And pumpkin pie. Did I say pumpkin pie? Pumpkin pie. Must be pumpkin
pie.
And now because we have our friend, my friend Victoria, her husband, is also at Thanksgiving. I make a version, apparently, of his. Apparently, I can channel his mother, who is not with us anymore, and so I make a bourbon pecan pie for him. Cooking is a powerful tool. When you can make something for someone, and they stand there and taste it, and it brings their eyes well up with tears because it takes them somewhere that they haven't been. That's a powerful thing, and so it means a lot. That you could do it.
Well, and I think that we're almost out of time, and I actually think that's a wonderful segue to letting people know about your book, because I think that's a lot of what probably drives you both, is that you both really feel the power of food, of sharing it, of the emotions it can bring to people. And the book I'm talking about, folks, is Forking Fantastic, and it's by Zora O'Neill and Tamara Reynolds, and it's about putting the party back in dinner party. It's a very fun book. The language is very accessible and easy. They've got some incredible tips and some wonderful recipes, and I think you can tell from listening to them for a little while that they're very upbeat about it all, but they bring a sort of seriousness and respect to it, even though they're having a lot of fun. So I really wanted to share it with our listeners. So I thank you both so much, wish you a really wonderful holiday, and hope that this is just the first of many times we'll have an opportunity to chat together about what's going on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us on. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Take care. Well, that's it for our show this week, the Edible Community Show on the Heritage Radio Network. I've been your host, Deborah Shapiro, and I'll be back on November 30th with Eleanor and Albert Legere, and they're the makers of Eden Ice Cider, and they're the first to bring it to the United States. It's going to be a very exciting program. But I want to thank my guests, Julie Schaefer and Zora O'Neill and Tamara Reynolds, for being with me today for a terrific show. And I also want to thank our sponsor, Ferry Market. There's no other place like it. So thanks so much.